Don't worry about trains. Hereabouts. They come when they can. What do you mean?
There's no timetable, you know.
What do you expect? This is no Reichsbahndienst.
But after all, trains come through from time to time, naturally,
but you can never predict them.
He smiled and gestured vaguely.
Have a seat here with us. You've got plenty of time.
No. I haven't got plenty of time. I've got to get out of here. I'm not going to sit here gassing with you. Suit yourself. If you'd rather walk around outside and get cold. Or you could hike over to Vinnytsia. Trains go through them more regularly. Only I warn you, it's 40 miles through thick woods, infested with the friends of these fellows here. He nodded toward the railwaymen, who aren't exactly in agreement with Adolf, and who might very well put an end to your leave. He looked at the Russians and grinned. They smiled back, without any idea why.
What do you mean?
I asked.
Partisans, for God's sake?
You mean those bastards are around here, too?
This time, it was his turn to be astonished.
Of course. And in Romania too, and in Hungary, and Poland. Maybe even in Germany. I was flabbergasted. So sit down, young fellow. It's a big mess that really has nothing to do with you, and you shouldn't be mixed up in it at all. It would be crazy to get killed just for the sake of a few hours. I managed to get hold of some real coffee, and it's here in this kitchen, nice and hot. There's a fellow at the commissary with a good heart, who's just about fed up with this war himself. He came back carrying a big army coffee pot. We drink enough coffee here to send us right up the walls, he said, looking at the Popovs, who were still smiling. I felt somewhat disconcerted.
Would you mind telling me what your job is?
Hell. He said in irritation. I'm supposed to be guarding that pile of boxes. He nodded at the neatly stacked crates outside and these poor fellows here. Who the hell do they think I am? Nearly 60 years old, and they bring me here to play sentry. I spent 30 years of my life working for the railways in Prussia and Germany, and this is the thanks I get. Specialization, that's what it is. No useless efforts. Everyone in his place. An efficient force.
Sig Heil.
I can tell you I'm fed up. By the time he was finished, he was shouting. He slammed the coffee pot down on the table. We might have been in a Paris bistro. I felt as if the world had suddenly turned upside down. That coffee pot is army property, and you just took it, I said, clinging to the thread of my first idea. The fellow looked at me, and slowly put down a cup, which he filled with steaming liquid. Then he held it out to me. Here, young fellow. Drink this. There was a moment of silence, and then he began talking again in a calm, serious tone which one could interrupt only with difficulty. Now, you listen to me, my boy. I am 57 years old. I fought in the cavalry in 1418, and was a prisoner in Holland for 2 years. Now it's been 3.5 years since they put me back in the army again. I have 3 sons fighting on 3 of the fronts which our beloved country has decided to defend. I am an old man, and even if I once felt fiery about political principles which have long since been altered by time, the politics of today leave me cold, and I don't give any more of a damn for them than I do for this coffee pot. So drink in a little of the heat it offers you, and take this chance to forget for a few minutes that you're mixed up in all this mess. I looked at him, astounded. I'm not a spies, or an officer, or the Führer, but only an old railway worker who was forced to change uniforms. Sit down and relax and drink your coffee. But what you just said is outrageous. After all, every minute of the day soldiers are dying for our country, and if our country needs something from me, I'll postpone my retirement for a couple of years. But, I felt as if I were choking. I couldn't find the words to express the intensity of emotion which German idealism created in me. I had already suffered a great deal from the war, but couldn't conceive a life other than the one assigned to me. I felt that this man was somehow missing the point, and that I was unable to express it adequately. Perhaps I was too young to understand it. I don't agree with you at all. I shouted, beside myself with rage. If everyone thought the way you did, nothing would be worth anything. Your way of thinking strips life of all its meaning. His gun was lying in the corner of the room. Your friends might pick that up, I said, nodding at the gun, and then at the pop-offs. Did that ever occur to you? I thought he was going to throw me out. But his attitude was inconsistent. Perhaps he was a little afraid of me. I'll take the coffee pot back when we're through with it, he said with a bitter laugh. Would you like a little more? I held out my cup, feeling pleased with myself for putting a fellow soldier back on the right track. I waited for more than 9 hours, and had almost given up hope, when at last a train arrived and took me away. Cancelled leave, partisans, on the train from Vinnytsia toward Lvov and Lublin. I was traveling with soldiers who'd been at Cherkasy and Kromenchug. They told me about the hellish fighting which had taken place near those towns, now lost to us or slipping from our grasp. Everywhere, the crushing numerical superiority of the enemy was finally overwhelming our positions, which we defended with desperate determination, paying an appalling price in casualties. All the fellows on the train were going on leave too, but despite their joy, they seemed crushed by the experiences they had just lived through. The train came into Lublin station at dawn on a winter morning. The ground was covered with snow, and the polished cold felt much sharper than the cold in Russia. Even though we were used to sleeping outdoors, no one had been able to rest on the train, and we greeted the morning with turned-up collars and grey faces. Despite the early hour, the station platforms were crowded with soldiers walking up and down to keep warm, dressed and equipped for the front. There were many new recruits, easily distinguishable by their boyish, rosy faces. Military police had been stationed at intervals of 10 yards down the length of the platform for incoming trains. I had overestimated my strength. As I obeyed the orders barked over the PA system, and jumped down onto the platform, I was shaking with sleeplessness and cold, and my legs were buckling under me. We lined up parallel to the train, and marched into the big hall which stood at one end of the station. As we tramped toward the hall, the gasping locomotive pulled the empty train onto a secondary track. In the hall, we were each given a cup of steaming ersatz and 2 spoonfuls of a curious jam. As we ate, several officers climbed onto a wheeled platform equipped with a loudspeaker. Military policemen were standing watchfully on either side of them, and at the foot of the platform. First, the amplifier crackled and buzzed for a moment, and then a nasal voice roared unintelligibly until someone adjusted the mechanism. The principal thrust of the officer's speech struck all of us like a slap in the face. Leaves must be cancelled. We thought we must have misunderstood him. But then the familiar series, necessity, difficulty, duty, supplementary effort, victory brought it home to us that this was no dream. The crowd buzzed angrily, and a few fellows even shouted their outrage. But the loudspeakers were already blaring the Deutsche Marsch, drowning our fury in martial music. As the hopes and plans of several thousand men crumbled, the music grew louder. The jam we were swallowing suddenly seemed tasteless, and the ersatz bitter. Before we had time to feel sorry for ourselves, the MPS were herding us toward a train which was ready to leave for the east. 3 cars were loaded with supplies for the troops, and we were ordered to line up beside them. Because our nervous exhaustion and disappointment were so evident, and the desire to desert was so clearly stamped on so many faces, we were closely hemmed in by police. We were issued fur hats, like the hats worn by Russian troops, crudely made over vests of reversed sheepskin, cotton gloves with woolen linings, and enormous overshoes with reinforced cork soles and felt uppers. A few boxes of tinned food were added to this voluminous issue, and we no longer entertained any doubts as to our fate. We were obviously being shipped back for another winter in Russia. Most of us were ready to cry with disappointment. The train was crammed to the bursting point. Some of the passengers were young boys about to go into combat for the first time. Others were veterans returning from leave, who were scarcely any happier than we were, and others, like myself, had been suddenly obliged to replace their plans for leave with the sinking apprehension which all men, no matter how brave, feel as they are about to confront a highly problematical fate. We rolled east for a considerable time, before we finally grasped what had happened to us. I was dumb with disappointment, remembering Magdeburg and my despair when the scope of that leave was abruptly limited. This time Berlin wasn't even on my route, and there was no chance of encountering Paula. There had been no period of grace at all, not even 24 hours. As I thought about it, the weight of what had just occurred seemed to increase, dragging me down into a black depression. However, I still had one hope. As soon as I had returned to my unit, I would have my status as a convalescent officially verified. Why hadn't I thought of explaining that to the police at the station? But, of course, no one in his right mind should ever expect anything decent from a military policeman. My last chance was that once I got back to the company, Wesredo would be able to arrange things for me. As always, the trains for the front were moving at top speed, unlike westbound trains, which often made long, inexplicable stops. Ours was no exception to this rule. Nevertheless, an important incident broke our momentum. The locomotive had just refueled and resumed the speed which was to carry us through to Vinnytsia. The station where we had stopped had bristled with signs bearing the names of towns no longer accessible to us: Konotop, Busk, Kharkov, names which evoked unbearably painful memories. About 15 minutes out of the station, the train braked so violently that all the carriages shuddered, and we nearly left the rails. Inside, men and boxes were flung to the floor, and the air rang with angry curses. We all thought we had in fact been derailed. Soldiers in long coats were running down the length of the tracks, answering our shouted questions by waving ahead. "You were lucky we could stop you," one of them yelled. About 500 yards to the east, the track, which ran between two walls of sparse woodland, was blocked by a chaos of overturned cars. We jumped down to the ground to find out what had happened. Partisans. Dynamite on the track. Train loaded with munitions. 150 soldiers killed. Reprisals. Patrols. Pursuit. The immediate work had already been divided among 300 unhurt soldiers. One group remained on the spot to help the wounded and another left in pursuit of the partisans, who had not been content simply to derail a train, but had opened fire as our men struggled to get free of the wreckage. Officers were blowing their whistles, and at least 3,000 men from our train climbed down. We were divided into three groups. The largest of these, about 2,000 strong, was sent out in pursuit of the enemy. I was included in this section. The second was sent to help our wounded comrades, while the third was deployed in the immediate area, to ensure the protection of the train. The bulk of my belongings, like everyone else's, remained on the train, and at the blast of the whistle we dog-trotted off into the countryside, which lay under a foot of snow. Running through snow isn't easy. In less than 2 minutes one is lathered with sweat, and after 20 it is almost impossible to breathe. Within an hour one's lungs feel bruised by the pressure of one's ribs, and everything is dancing with colored lights. The weather wasn't very cold, and the effects of our gymnastic efforts nearly suffocated us. The non-coms and officers who had followed us eventually grew tired of sustaining a zealous performance and resumed a walking pace. An hour and a half after leaving the train, we slogged into a large peasant village, our heads drooping with fatigue. Almost all the houses had thatched roofs, and attached sheds made of woven sunflower stalks, for storing winter supplies. When we arrived, the place was already full of German soldiers, and the snow-covered central square was tightly packed with civilians, men, women, and children gesturing excitedly and talking loudly. Soldiers, some of them with spandaus ready to fire, were stationed all around the square, and toward the center other soldiers were shoving their way through the mass of civilians, roughly driving some of them off to one side. To the right, beside a building which probably served as the village hall, a third group of soldiers were standing with drawn guns over a dozen Russians lying on their stomachs in the snow. At first I thought they were dead. Partisans we caught here, explained one of the soldiers standing beside me. Were they really guilty, or were they only suspects? None of the questioning was up to me. The interrogations lasted for at least an hour. The Popovs lying on their stomachs must have had frozen guts, but that was true for our machine gunners too. An SS section had been included in the pursuit group. I had the honor of being assigned by them to a smaller group of 100 men who, like me, were returning to duty. Their attention was undoubtedly drawn to me by the edge of my left sleeve with its Gross Deutschland inscription. The SS preferred to use men belonging to elite divisions. Without explanation, we were loaded onto SS trucks, ignorant of the fate of the civilians lying on the ground. We drove for about 20 minutes over very hilly country. Then we were ordered to leave the trucks. An SS Hauptmann in a long, dark leather coat addressed us briefly. You will fan out to the right, and move into those woods, taking every precaution. A factory which you can't see from here is situated about 3/4 of a mile to the west. The Russian informants who are accompanying us have indicated that this is an important center of terrorist operations. We must take them by surprise and wipe them out. He appointed squad leaders, and we moved off. What a splendid convalescence. I would have done better to stay in the hospital at Vinnytsia. After a short time, we saw a series of metal roofs, which must have been part of the factory. But, before we had a chance to give them a second look, a burst of machine gun fire broke the silence. One of the SS men shouted, "We've got you, you bastards. You might as well give up." It looked as though the Russian partisans we'd caught in the village had given this place away under pressure. There were some more shots, and then the familiar clatter of Russian machine guns coming from the edge of the buildings. Another fellow and I threw ourselves down under a small tree, whose snow-laden branches touched the ground. We heard whistles ordering us to advance, but for the moment I stayed where I was. It would be too stupid to get knocked off by a handful of terrorists. The other fellow muttered in my ear, "The bastards. We've really got them this time. Now we'll teach them to blow up trains." After 5 minutes of hard fighting, German soldiers began to stand up all around us. We had taken about 10 more Russian prisoners. Some were singing a Russian song of vengeance, but most were begging for mercy. About 30 SS men were herding them toward the truck, already beating them and shouting questions. We thought everything was over, when the SS captain blew his whistle to fall in. "Those bastards," he said, gesturing at the sobbing prisoners, "claim they're the only ones here. Maybe they think they can fool us and protect their friends who are still hiding inside, but I want you to clear the place." He pointed at the factory buildings. "We've got to take the whole bunch, and all the weapons they're hiding there." Of course, there was no question of argument. With dry mouths, we moved forward into the factory buildings, which were littered with hundreds of large objects ideal for snipers and as bad as possible for us. The relatively large size of our force was in no way reassuring. Even if we overwhelmed the partisans in the end, each bullet they fired was bound to hit someone, and if I should happen to be the only casualty in a victorious army of 1 million men, the victory would be without interest for me. The percentage of corpses, in which generals sometimes take pride, doesn't alter the fate of the men who've been killed. The only leader I know of who finally made a sensible remark on this point, Adolf Hitler, once said to his troops, "Even a victorious army must count its victims." What was made in this factory lost in the wilderness? Perhaps they processed timber. The first shed housed a large bandsaw, and farther on we passed several others, as well as a kind of dredging machine with a string of rusty scoops. The first two sheds were empty. Perhaps the prisoners had been telling the truth. But our orders were to check the whole place. Our group surrounded the entire factory complex, and then began to move toward the center. We passed through a series of enormous barn-like buildings which seemed to be on the point of collapse. They had never been painted, and every iron fixture was half eaten away by rust, like the old anchor chains at a port. The wind was blowing hard, and the buildings echoed with sinister creaking sounds. Otherwise, everything was quiet, except for an occasional clatter made by one of our men deliberately shoving aside some metal object, or overturning a pile of crates. About 8 of us had moved into the darkness of a building littered with a jumble of miscellaneous clutter. There were no windows, and consequently there was almost no light. Then we all heard a series of clicking sounds. But the wind blowing through the building filled the air with the bangings and clickings of loose boards and tiles. Although everyone understood that theoretically each moment might be our last, no one really accepted that idea, and no one took any special precautions. Outside, the SS must have cornered several Russians. We heard a series of shots and cries, and sounds of running and shouting. Suddenly, our shed was filled with the noise of explosions. 5 or 6 flares thrown from a room or closet in an upper story lit the darkness, and almost simultaneously 4 of our companions screamed with pain. A moment later, 2 of them had collapsed onto the dusty floor, while the other 2 staggered toward the open door. The rest of us looked hastily for shelter, stumbling through the darkness, uncertain of where we might find cover. There were several more shots, and somewhere to my right 2 more soldiers howled with pain. My gun shuddered violently in my hands. A bullet had struck it in the butt, taking a piece with it, and missing me by inches. The 2 fellows trying to get to the door were both hit again, but neither of them fell until they had reached a drift of white snow which the wind had blown over the threshold. Outside, more soldiers had run up, but they stopped at the door and fired a few shots which were far more likely to hit one of us than any partisan. There were 2 of us still unhurt, and we began to shout as if we were 50. Some idiot might think of tossing in a grenade, which would finish us off along with all the Russians. Luckily, someone heard us in time to think of another tactic. While our comrades outside tried to break through the corrugated iron walls, the Russians inside were firing at every detectable movement. The bullets, which pierced the flimsy walls, were as dangerous to our men outside as they were to us. I was half dead with fright. Was I going to be the last German soldier left in that damned shack? I knew that at least one other comrade was hiding somewhere. I felt even more caught in a vice of terror and danger than I had at Belgrade. I bit my lips to keep from screaming. Our men outside were pressing in, about to blow the building apart, while inside the Russians were perched in the rafters as silent as spiders. From where I lay, I could see nothing. Suddenly I heard a scratching noise behind me, somewhere between a haphazard pile of objects and an upright support. I froze as still as the large glazed pipe behind which I was hiding. The uproar outside prevented me from distinguishing anything clearly. I tried deliberately to extend my hearing beyond the limit of its capacity, and caught a series of scratching sounds, some very faint, some a little louder. I held my breath until my lungs were on the point of bursting, and tried to stop the pounding of my heart. My brain was teeming with horrible possibilities. I saw myself dead or a prisoner of the partisans, who would use me in an attempt to escape from a noose. I was overwhelmed with an intensity of panic greater than anything I had ever felt before, which was suddenly replaced by a savage passion of self-preservation. Trembling with terror and rage, I abruptly stopped thinking. Some supplementary sense informed me that danger had drawn very close. Had I been a millionaire, I would have staked my entire fortune on the certainty that someone was moving on the other side of the barrier which concealed me. I felt very much alone and desperate and determined to defend myself at any price. Suddenly I saw a man no more than 5 yards from me. I felt my skin crawl. Then a second man appeared behind him, crawling toward a pile of sacks. Although they had both been in shadow, I had seen enough to recognize civilian clothes. The one nearest me was wearing a large cap. His silhouette remains indelibly stamped on my memory. He was tall and looked strong. He froze for a moment and appeared to be inspecting the shadows. Then he moved a few steps away from me. As slowly and silently as sand running through an hourglass, I raised my gun until it was pointing at him. I knew that there was still one bullet left in the barrel, so I didn't have to move the bolt. Tightening every nerve, I tried to suppress the trembling which made my gestures uncertain. I knew that at the slightest sound the other fellow would let me have it. Luckily, there was plenty of noise outside, which divided his attention. My gun was now level, and my finger lay nervously against the trigger. Then I hesitated for a moment. It isn't easy to kill a man in cold blood, unless one is entirely heartless or, as I was, numb with fear. The man changed his course a little, and began to move slowly toward my hiding place. His companion was scarcely visible now, and must have been some 20 yards away from us. I could hear the man breathing as he approached. For a moment, perhaps, he distinguished a figure crouching in the shadows, or glimpsed a dull metallic gleam. For a tenth of a second, perhaps, he hesitated. Then a sudden glow of brilliant light blinded him, and he collapsed in the dust, his belly torn open by the shot fired from the weapon which still quivered in my sweat-drenched hands. The other Russian had run off, leaving his companion dead at my feet. I felt as if my skull enclosed a black void, and that a nightmare enclosed me, like a fever. As the noise outside grew louder, I felt myself sinking into a pit of unimaginable depth. I was torn between the desire to flee and my paralyzing fear. I stared at the corpse lying face down on the ground in front of me. I couldn't really believe I had killed him, and waited for the tide of blood which would soon begin to seep from beneath his body. Nothing else mattered to me. The weight of the drama which had just occurred was so overwhelming that I could only stare at the motionless body. Suddenly a piece of the wall collapsed. The soldiers outside had managed to pull off a section of corrugated sheeting, and the glare of full daylight somehow diminished the importance of what had happened. The sight of other German soldiers entering the building snapped me from my lethargy. I even distinguished the SS captain, who had just joined them, ducking down behind a piece of crumpled metal. He was facing me, at a distance of about 20 yards. "Anyone still alive in here?" he shouted. I waved a hand, and he saw me. I knew that there was still at least one Russian in the building, and I didn't want to attract too much attention to myself. Another German, who must have been as terrified as I was, shouted from somewhere deeper in the ruins, "Over here, Kameraden. I've got a wounded man, too." "Don't move yet," the captain shouted back. "We're going to clear out the rest of the Popovs." He had just spotted the dead man, lying almost at my feet. We heard the sound of an engine, which was rapidly growing louder. From my hiding place, I could see a black machine gun carrier rolling across the snow. A moment later, it was thrusting through the hole in the wall, with an SMG pointing from its turret. A powerful headlight lit up the shed, and soldiers crouched beside the vehicle were aiming their guns at the interior. The beam of light passed over me for a moment, and a shiver ran down my spine. I could almost imagine the faces of the waiting Russians, contorted with terror. In the doorway, beside the two German bodies, I could see other German soldiers regrouping. The Hauptmann shouted, "Surrender, or we'll shoot you down like rats." There was no answer. Then a cry of terror rang out from the dimly lit rafters, like the cry I had fought back in myself a few moments before. The heavy machine gun began its slaughter. Each explosion echoed through the shed as if it would blow it apart. The bullets themselves were explosive and ripped open the roof, letting in new streams of daylight. All the German soldiers outside were firing into the rafters, where some 15 Russian terrorists were still hiding. I doubled over onto the floor, and pressed my hands against my ears, trying to deaden the sound. Directly overhead, I could hear Russian machine guns. Once again, there were blood-curdling screams, and a body fell to the floor with the heavy thud of a quarter carcass thrown down onto the butcher's block. The SMG demolished the rest of the roof, and full daylight flooded in, destroying the partisans' last hope of invisibility and escape. Another fell to the floor as the rest began a frantic attempt to scramble away through the twisted metal supports overhead. Some dropped to the floor, others clung to the rafters. In the end, all were killed, and our deaths on the train were avenged. The place filled with German soldiers, and I was able to leave my hideout.